Coming up on Golf Today, meeting in Memphis. Commissioner Jay Monahan holds a powwow with the players ahead of the playoffs. What do we know? A full report is upcoming. And the two best players in golf are tinkering with their putters. Sound the alarm for Scotty and Rory, or just the hazards of a very tough business? And by the skin of his Tar Heels, Ben Griffin just makes it into the playoffs after a miscut and a long wait. But now he's walking in Memphis and talking to us on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Hello, Golf Today on a Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. And once again, it is a very, very busy day. Here's what you need to know on this Wednesday. TPC Southwind hosts a postseason event for the second year in a row as the tour's top players from the regular season take part in the opening tournament of the three-week FedEx Cup playoffs. So what is at stake for the best players in the world? How about 51 through 70 going to carry FedEx Cup points earned during the regular season and in Memphis into the FedEx Cup fall? The top 50 now will advance to the BMW Championship with guaranteed access to all signature events in 2024. And finally, the top 30 following the BMW advance to the Tour Championship in Atlanta earned 2-year exemption on the PGA Tour and an invitation to the 2024 Masters. Besides the golf tournament, there was a PGA Tour player meeting held Tuesday night with Commissioner Jay Monahan. Kira K. Dixon has the latest in Memphis.
Yeah, Damon, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan is back in action after taking some time for medical leave. He hosted a meeting here in Memphis last night for about 25 players out of a 70-man field. Ricky Fowler and Scottie Scheffler were a few of the names in attendance in that meeting, and they shared some insights from topics discussed last night.
I went to the player meeting yesterday, and I realized I hadn't seen Jay in quite a bit of time. So, it's definitely good to have him back. I think the tour's got a long way to go. But it's always nice having Jay back in person. You know, guys, when they want to, can have face-to-face time with him. He's always available, and you know, he's doing the best that he can to make sure that he's getting as much player input as possible.
You mentioned the tour still has a long way to go. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Does that mean in terms of explaining the deal to players or the details of it? I was wondering if you could just expand on that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have the framework agreement, which nobody's, you know, entirely sure what that means. And then you got whatever they're working towards. And the position where I'm sitting now, it just seems like they got a long way to go in that sense, to where, you know, there's still really not much to say, and there's, I mean, we still don't really have a great idea as to what is going on right now.
It was a small meeting. Obviously, we're here with a 70-man field. There was probably 20, 25 guys in there because it wasn't mandatory. It was more, want to hear from Jay. There's a handful of us that have been on phone calls, whether we're part of the board, the pack, some top players. So a few of us kind of were up to speed on everything that he was going to be kind of talking or addressing. But for the most part, just, I guess, good to see him in person. Saw him on FaceTime last week, but, see him here and back doing what, you know, he wants to be doing. So good to see him healthy. And, you know, for me, from the meeting, nothing really new, like I said, since I've been a part of calls and hearing about some of the stuff that was in the works with Tiger and some of the player requests and things like that. So, just wanted to be there, hear from some other guys. There wasn't too much of Q&A. It was just wanting to continue to learn more about what's going on, the position we're in. And I think we all just kind of continue to learn as we go. Because, under the framework agreement, it's, not saying there's necessarily a partnership or that all this is going to go through. It's, trying to work together to ultimately see what can be done. And at the end of the day, if it doesn't work out, or the board or the players don't think it's the best step forward, then reassess and go from there.
Well, joining me now is Rex Hoggard, senior writer with GolfChannel.com. Rex, based on my conversation with Ricky earlier today, my impression was that this framework agreement that we keep hearing about is in no way guaranteed to reach a definitive place with the public investment fund. What are your takeaways based on conversations with players after yesterday's meeting?
Yeah, I talked to Ricky last night after the meeting, Tom Hoge, a couple of other players, and it is interesting that I think in the public the idea is that this is a foregone conclusion, that the tour will reach this definitive agreement with the PIF and they will come up with whatever NewCo or PGA Tour Enterprises is going to be. And that's clearly not the case. I mean, these conversations are ongoing. You and I both had a chance to meet with the commissioner this morning, and he pointed out that there was a series of meetings last week on Sunday and Monday, and that there'll be more meetings next week. Probably the biggest thing, and I took this from the meeting with the commissioner, that so many things going on right now with the PGA Tour, but it seems like his number one job is rebuilding the trust that was lost when they announced this framework agreement. And as it applies specifically to this, he pointed out that the only way this happens is if all six players on their policy board agree with whatever the definitive agreement is going to be. And that's an uphill climb right now for the commissioner.
Yeah, it was a really interesting discussion that the two of us got to attend. We got to attend our own meeting with the PGA Tour commissioner as well. It was an informal discussion, about 13 members of the media this morning. Other than what you just mentioned, what were your other main takeaways from the discussion that we got to be a part of?
Going back to June 6th, and in professional golf, that's been a date that's kind of been embedded in us going forward. That's the day the framework agreement was announced, and I asked him specifically what he would have done over. And there's a lot of things that was going through my mind when I asked the question. And the idea that he came back with is he felt rushed on June 5th. He felt like he needed to get this out into the public, and that if he had to do over again, if he could get a mulligan, that he would have made sure that he got in front of the players and informed them of everything that was going to happen long before it ever became public. Now, in his defense, this had to be negotiated in secret. We've all sort of learned about how this all came about. But he looks back now and he realizes that he left the players in a really, really bad position, and he wishes he wouldn't have done that.
Yes, and he also went into a bunch of topics. Tiger Woods joining the PGA Tour Policy Board was one of those. He said that Tiger Woods doesn't do anything lightly, so it'll be really interesting to see how that continues to evolve as well. But he, as you mentioned, said that those ongoing discussions will continue to be ongoing. They have plans to meet with representatives from the Public Investment Fund later in New York Sunday and Monday of this upcoming week. So, guys, as always, the story continues to evolve.
Yes, it does. Kira K. Dixon and Rex Hoggard in Memphis at TPC Southwind. You agree with Rex there that the number one job right now, the commissioner, not the details of NewCo and this framework agreement, but rebuilding the trust with the players?
Yeah, that's what Jay Monahan said in his own memo to players last week. He referred to reconnecting with players. And he's not just talking in a social sense because he'd been on a medical leave for a month. He's talking very much about the idea of rebuilding trust between the membership and the executive, which has very clearly been eroded. That's been very evident, even in the statements that we've had from the PGA Tour acknowledging that there's been that erosion of trust. And, you know, what we're hearing from the players signals two things. It shows how Jay Monahan is personally popular with players. They do like him, but he's professionally stressed right now. And it's not just the idea of rebuilding a connection with his own membership. It's this idea of getting this deal to the finish line, because Jay and some members of the board have so much personal equity invested in this deal that if it doesn't get to the finish line, if the players don't want it or the negotiations simply don't take it there, well, then it's going to call into question the future of those who push this deal on the PGA Tour. And it's surprising that it's not surprising that Jay's talking about how it was poorly handled, poorly communicated to his own members on June 6th, and that he felt rushed to do that. I'm not sure why he felt rushed, because the framework agreement included a clause from the Saudi side that a press release had to go out a week after this deal was signed. So that deadline was always there in advance. It wasn't as though it suddenly popped up and they had to get it out before it was going to leak. That was by design. And it clearly wasn't by design on the PGA Tour side that the news would be rushed out there.
Difficult for the players, the best players in the world, in your mind, to keep their eye on the golf ball, as it were, with all the unknowns of 2024 and beyond. It's not just about birdies and bogeys. Usually it is, but it's also about the future framework of what their tour is going to look like. That has to be at least back of mind, if not top of mind.
It's back of mind for most of them, and has been for several years. I mean, we all know who the players are who went front and center on this. The reality is most players didn't fire a shot in defense of their own tour over the last few years, didn't get involved in that. And even those who did, to to some extent and took positions on it didn't seem to suffer in terms of the erosion of time devoted to other aspects of the game or their career. Eventually, Rory McIlroy said it started to get too much and he was backing off from that. But it was impossible for him and now for Tiger and others to not be part of it. And you put Cantley and Simpson and Malnati in the same boat. They're on the board. They can't actually avoid being part of these discussions and driving the narrative forward of what direction the PGA Tour needs to go. For most people, it's just simply not an issue. They can't really impact it. And right now, as we just heard from Scottie Scheffler and Ricky Fowler, there's nothing to actually impact. Yeah. And that's the reason why there wasn't a huge turnout last night. Relative to the size of the field, I suppose it was a big enough turnout. But there's just no new details to be given because the negotiations are ongoing. And they have until the end of the year by their own deadline schedule to get there. They can obviously extend that, but there is nothing to share with players. So that's why I think a lot of players are just saying, OK, we're going to wait and see. But there's a sense of impatience. I don't know if you heard it there from these guys. It's like, we want something to be able to digest.
Something to chew on.
But it's not there.
Ongoing discussions, yes, and also ongoing bridge building, I would say, between the commissioner and the players as well.
And that's going to last quite a while. We're going to stick with the playoffs. We're going to flash back to last week, the Wyndham Championship. Ben Griffin entered the week number 68 in the FedEx Cup standings, but he missed the cut after rounds of 70 and 73. And as he tells you, that puts the fate out of his hands.
I'll probably practice this weekend and try to get ready for next week. And, you know, if I don't get in, obviously I'll have quite the long time off. So it's kind of an interesting scenario I'm in. It's not a scenario I want to be in. You'd much rather be in control of your destiny. So, yeah, I'll just have to wait, and I'll probably try to work on a few things this weekend, maybe Sunday, and we'll see where the chips fall.
So you go home and think and wait?
Yeah, probably. I try not to plan on missed cuts, so, like, I don't know what my plan is now. I'll just have to change, you know, tip the locker room attendants, thank the volunteers, and, you know, wait and see what happens.
But Justin Thomas needed birdie on the 72nd hole Sunday to finish in that 70th spot to get into the playoffs. But when this chip shot ricocheted off that flagstick, he finished in 71st place. And that meant Ben Griffin narrowly qualified for the playoffs in that number 70 slot.
And Griffin took to Twitter shortly after. Feel awful for JT. He's been playing great and has had some unlucky breaks recently. Taking a break, time away, is healthy. He'll come back better than ever. I also can't help but thank the flagstick on 18 for shipping me to the playoffs. And Mr. 70 Ben Griffin joins us now. Ben, I imagine when you missed the cut in Greensboro, you were a hot tamale. What was going through your mind? Did you think you'd missed out on the playoffs?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to say it was an emotional roller coaster this past weekend. There was a lot going through my head. I didn't know if it was my somewhat off season, you know, for the next month and a half, 2 months, or if I was playing this week in Memphis. So I wanted to do what I could to prepare here for Memphis and just let the, you know, the chips fall where they do. But I'd be lying if I didn't say I had flights booked for every single scenario. So I was ready to go home if I had to. I was ready to go to Memphis, and I'm very fortunate it worked out, and I have a chance to make a run at the playoffs here.
Ben, from being on the bubble last week, you're at the back of the pack this week as number 70, top 50. Move on to the BMW next week. Do you have a different mindset this week because you've got four rounds to try to make your move and you can't be sent home after 36 holes?
Yeah, I mean, you got to almost treat it like a regular event, though. I mean, you know, just because I have four chances at it doesn't mean that one round can't just, you know, erase my chances. I've got to stay focused from the get-go in the first round and stay focused the entire way. You know, just because there's not a cut doesn't mean there's, you know, it's things are going to be given to me. I still got to go out there and earn it. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's an opportunity, four times the points in the playoffs. So, you know, a good finish here does a lot more than a solid finish, you know, last week or any other week the rest of the year. So I know if I play really solid, get myself in the mix, hopefully, you know, try to win, and that solves everything. But, you know, if I play solid this week, I can easily work my way into next week. And, you know, the better I play, the better chance I have of getting to East Lake, where it all comes down to that for the FedEx Cup. So just got to take it one day at a time, but I got to stay focused, that's for sure.
Ben, we saw your tweet to Justin Thomas and the flagstick. Where were you Sunday afternoon? Were you watching every shot? Were you on your phone? How'd you handle Sunday afternoon?
Sunday was a whirlwind. You know, there were so many different, you know, different scenarios that could have played out. I was trying to my best to practice at the golf course. I was in Chapel Hill at my parents' house, and right across the street is UNC's facility. So I was back there with a couple guys from the team, with the coach there, practicing, trying to get my mind off of it. But, you know, every 10 minutes I'd, you know, hit a few balls and check my phone and run inside and look. But, you know, after that rain delay, I was back at home with my parents and my girlfriend, and we were kind of sweating things out together. I told them they can't say a word unless it's a good thing, because there was just so much on my mind. You know, Adam Scott had jumped me. You know, there was a couple different scenarios where other guys could have, you know, played their way into the 70. And yeah, watching that chip coming down the stretch, I kind of knew if he made that, it was probably game over for me, unless something catastrophic happened to one of the leaders, with that being Lucas Glover or Horschel. You know, those guys were kind of controlling my destiny. So there's so many things. You know, JT Poston made his par putt, Michael Kim birdied the last hole. It was nuts. I didn't know what to think. I was, you know, I'm obviously pulling for myself, trying to give myself a chance, but you know, everything was out of my control, and I just had to let things happen. And so very fortunate for things to have worked out, and you got a feel for Justin Thomas. That was an incredible effort. I don't know how that chip didn't go in. I'd gotten a text right before the chip happened. My TV was a little delayed, and it was just the big eye emojis, and I was like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And watched it happen, and I couldn't believe it. It was nuts, and I hate to see it come down to that is the reason he's not here and I'm here, but you know, I've got a chance. I earned enough points to make it, and now I've got to do my best to take advantage of it and try to make a run and create a cool story.
Let's hope it's not as stressful on Sunday this week as it was last week. Have you done any investigating of the sort of what you need to qualify for the top 50 next week? Are any of those projections on your radar at all?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I had so much time this past weekend to look at just about every single scenario for everything. So I know that a top, you know, 7 or 8 probably gets me enough points to next week, and a top 3 probably gets me to Eastlake. It's a tournament, though. I talked about this last week. I try to talk about it every week. And when my tee time starts on Thursday, my mindset's all on trying to get the job done. Now, do I know what position I need to finish to make it? Yeah, I do. Absolutely. We did some of the math, and you know, I just had too much time on my hands to where I was looking at too many things. I'd say any other week, I don't really care, and I'm just trying to win and, you know, show up to the tournament and do my best. So I do know what's at stake. There's a lot, and, you know, I'm very fortunate to be here and to have that chance to make a huge run.
So best-case scenario, we're talking to you again next week as we did last week. Worst-case scenario, if you don't make the BMW, are you happy with how your rookie season has gone out there?
Yeah, I said this last week too. It's been an awesome year. You know, as a rookie, you don't have anything guaranteed to you early on, and I was able to work my way into some big time events, the Arnold Palmer, you know, major championships, the Players Championship. A lot of those events rookies don't have a chance at, and so I was able to play in a lot of events this year. I was able to get a lot of experience, and I think as a rookie, you know, my expectations, I want to win as soon as I can, but also this first year, I want to get comfortable with all these golf courses, get a feel for how the flow of things are, figure out where I might want to take a week off next year, and give myself more rest leading up to events. So I've learned so much this year, and as a rookie, I mean, that's really what you can all you can ask for. Try to, you know, get comfortable playing against the best players in the world, figure out what courses you like the most, and just try to learn and figure out your stats. You know, playing on the PGA Tour, I have access to all the data online to figure out where exactly I'm lacking compared to the best players, where I'm doing a better job. So I can figure out, you know, what I need to do to be better this offseason and try to improve on certain areas to, you know, get in the mix more often next year and try to, you know, get that first win and break that barrier. So, you know, overall, it's been an awesome year. Just to make it to the playoffs with it only being 70 this year is, I think, a good accomplishment for me. And I'd be lying if I said I wasn't hungry for more, though. But, you know, whatever happens, I'm happy with where I'm at. And all I can do is try my best this week.
And, Ben, you've done this in the midst of a very turbulent year in professional golf. Yesterday, a players meeting with the commissioner, Jay Monahan. Did you go? What is your assessment of where things stand outside the ropes in the game?
Yeah, it's definitely a turbulent time. I personally did not go. I was on the golf course preparing for the tournament this week. I had some flight issues. On top of that, my clubs didn't make it until mid-morning yesterday, so I knew I needed to play 18 holes, especially with a little bit of weather today. I wanted to make sure I got 18 holes in yesterday. I heard maybe a third of the players here might have gone. I don't really know what information was really given. I remember back at the RBC Canadian Open, people were talking about Tommy Fleetwood, how he was kind of avoiding some of the meetings and just focusing on the tournament. I really loved it when I saw that mindset, because I went to the first couple meetings as a rookie. I didn't really know what they were like. Now that I've been on tour for almost a year, I feel like all I can do as a player is just try to play my best and let all the stuff that's going on off the course, controlling the game, kind of happen. There's not really much I can do. I'm not a voice like one of the top players in the world where my opinions truly matter, in my opinion, that much. If I continue to work on my craft and play really well out here, maybe, you know, my voice could be bigger one day. But with that being said, there's so much going on. All I can do is focus on playing my best golf, and whatever happens with, you know, the executives and people in charge of, you know, the LIV Tour and this proposed merger, it's gonna work out the way it does. And all I can do as a player is try to play my best, because I know how many good players there are in this game, how many good players there are on the Korn Ferry Tour, how many good players there are on many tours trying to just get their opportunity at playing on, whether it's the PGA Tour, whether it's whatever tour. They're trying to chase after my spot here in the playoffs. Someone's going to try to take that next year. So all I can do is try to be really good on the golf course. And you know, it's not my – I don't have the brain power to be thinking about some of those off-course things and controlling what happens with the tours. My job is to perform, and technically I'm an entertainer. And we're battling for meritocracy. That's one of the big things on the PGA Tour is meritocracy. So I know if I finish high, I'm gonna take care of a lot of things. So that's all I can do this week and every week is just try to play my best. And I'm trying my best to avoid all the off-course stuff.
Well, you've earned that spot, Ben. Best of luck this week, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you guys for having me.
Well, it's Big Ten week, and up next, we have one of the best young Big Ten players in the nation, Ohio State's rising senior, Max Moldovan. He's coming right after the break.
Great to have Maxwell with us on this Wednesday. Let's talk about that number 6 in the PGA Tour University rankings ahead of the season. How much will we be paying attention to where you stand and kind of following those pathways to the pro game?
I'll definitely be watching it a lot. I think with what they're doing with PGA Tour U and the incredible opportunities that it's going to provide us college players to jumpstart our pro career, I think you can't help but not pay attention to it. But I think a big thing for me is going to be to focus as much as I can on just playing golf. If I'm checking the rankings more than I should be and my head's not in the right place about just playing quality golf and letting the rest take care of itself, I think that's kind of the way I've got to go about it. I think, you know, it's a 2-year ranking system and we've got a full year left of it. So starting where I'm at, I'm very happy and thankful to start there, but I've got a long season ahead and got a lot of climbing to do if all goes well.
Maxwell, highs and lows are really part of this game and certainly the professional life. So it's got to be quite something to go from losing an 8-hole playoff in the darkness, hoping you would get into that US Open, to suddenly getting in as an alternate, then make the cut. What was your biggest takeaway from that experience around that US Open?
Yeah, I think it taught me a lot of patience. I think that whole week kind of in between the qualifier and when I got the call, thankfully I was at the Arnold Palmer Cup, so I had a little bit of something to kind of take my mind off of it. But I definitely thought about it a lot. My friends and family, we prayed about it a lot, just hoping that the right things would happen. And when I got that call, it was a roller coaster of emotions. But I kind of prepared as if I was going to get the call. And then if not, realized that a golf career ahead is a long way to go. And if I didn't get the chance to play, that hopefully I could earn it in the future. There was a ton of emotion around that week. And once I got to tee it up, I kind of felt like I had nothing to lose. And I think did a pretty good job those first couple rounds of putting together a couple good scores that was thankfully good enough to sneak inside the cut line. So those couple weeks were a lot to handle, but I'm really thankful for how it all played out.
This year's US Open was a good example of a learning curve as well, because you qualified last year at the Country Club and you said you played 18-hole practice rounds, I think it was 4 straight days, before the tournament actually started. You didn't do that this year. Why not?
I think last year, once I got to the U.S. Open, I was kind of just starstruck with, you know, all the grandstands and all the fans out there. So I wanted to kind of be out there as much as I could every day. And then being back this year, I kind of knew that my body was pretty tired and beat up after a lot of practice rounds that first year. So I kind of took it a little bit easier and spent a little bit more time on the practice facilities than I did actually walking and playing the course. And I think it played off. It paid off, and in the rest of the week, I was able to play pretty well.
Maxwell, my eyesight's getting bad, but behind you on the wall, I believe I see a picture of John Cook. Jack Nicklaus went to Ohio State. Tom Weisskopf played golf at Ohio State. What's it like being a college golfer at the Ohio State University?
It's amazing. The Ohio State sports community as a whole, I mean, you know, obviously the football team is as good as they are every year, and you just named some incredible players who I look up to a lot and hope to have a career anything similar to any of those guys. So it's an honor to be a Buckeye. We have an incredible sports community here in Columbus, and it's really cool to try to follow in those guys' footsteps and do the best job I can of carrying on the tradition of Ohio State athletics.
Maxwell, go Bucks. Thanks for the time, and best of luck going forward in your senior season.
Thank you guys for having me. God bless.
And you. Folks, stay with us. Another rising star in the game, Pearson Cootie, has secured his PGA Tour card for next season. He joins us next. And Pearson Cootie joins us now. Congratulations. You know, on Sunday, you said you still have so much to learn, so much to improve on. What do you have to improve on?
I feel like there's a lot to do, a lot to just get better at. It's awesome. I've had some really good tournaments, but I haven't had the consistency that I've wanted as a pro. So at least I know my good golf is pretty good, and I can kind of fill in the gaps between that.
Pearson, in your last victory a couple of weeks ago, you held off four guys by two shots, and one of the guys, second place, is your twin brother, Parker. How difficult is it for you to separate the relationship from the competitive environment?
It's honestly a lot of fun for us. I think it's been an easier transition than we both might have expected. I think the hardest part, though, was the beginning of this season on the Corn Ferry. I had full status and knew I'd be playing the whole year out here at least. And Parker had very limited conditional status after poor finish at final stage. So he was on some sponsor advice beginning of the season. And the first event, if he had made the cut, he would have shuffled up and got starts for the rest of the year. And I actually had to like watch him play the last nine holes the way our tee times fell. And I knew what it meant, and I wasn't playing well. And he had a poor finish. And that kind of started the season, knowing that every shot meant so much to him. Just playing the whole year was tough, but now that he's Monday qualified, finished fifth, earned his full status out here, and is inside the number chasing a tour card, it's honestly a lot of fun for us, just practice rounds and kind of just enjoying being out here together again.
Yeah, Pearson, typical week at home, how often are you eating meals together, practicing together, talking crap together? What's a typical week like for you guys?
Yeah, it is a lot of time together, practicing, especially working out with the same trainer. Now that you bring it up, it's constant. We are always together. But it's cool. It's given us, I think, an advantage to be able to practice together, do all those things together, because you're always trying to beat each other, and you're always trying to keep it competitive. And luckily, we've maintained a healthy relationship when we do go home, and a family dinner isn't a bad place for us.
Pearson, you mentioned earlier, excuse me, the need for consistency. You've played 16 events this year, had great success in them, missed eight cuts. Where's the balance between consistency and just really being opportunistic and taking full advantage of those weeks where you are really playing well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's been something that I guess you hear a lot, that as a pro golfer, that you know, hopefully your good weeks count for a lot, because that's, you know, the points are exponential towards the top. And so that's something that, yeah, I've been very fortunate to capitalize on. And the weeks in between the missed cuts, I try to take it with a good attitude, I guess. Just trying to, had an unfortunate off season, had surgery, and like just things in my golf swing and stuff like that has changed a lot. And I'm trying to get back on the right path with my swing and stuff. And I've had some weeks that the clubs felt great in my hands, and some weeks it's been a little different. So I think a lot of that consistency is still just building the right feels and all that stuff again. And hopefully next year on tour, I can kind of piece those things together.
Well, getting to watch you a little bit at Bay Hill early this year, you have tons of game. Congratulations on getting that card. We'll speak to you soon, Pearson.
Sounds good. Thank you, guys.
And the U.S. Women's Amateur is underway at Bel Air Country Club in Los Angeles. So we're going to talk to a member at Rival Riviera across town. Amy Alcott is with us. She knows a little something about winning at every level. We're going to hear from her when Golf Today continues.
Great to have the World Golf Hall of Fame member with us on this Wednesday. Amy, most people associate you with Riviera. What should we know about your relationship with Bel Air?
Well, I guess I got orange on. I'm Southern Californian as much as like an orange. these are great courses around here. You know, as I told you before, I grew up sneaking under the fence at Riviera and have a lot of great friends out at Bel Air. And, these are just great George Thomas golf courses, but all very different. And, the golfing public has really gotten to see a lot of great California golf recently.
Yeah, Amy, we saw a great test presented at the U.S. Open at L.A. Country Club. We obviously saw Riviera host the PGA Tour earlier this year. What kind of test do you expect Bel Air to produce?
Well, Bel Air is a feisty little golf course. You know, it's very different than Riviera. Riviera, I kind of term like, is like big sky country. It's like Montana. It's big environment. Bel Air is a great course. It's been remodeled. It kind of runs through these amazing canyons above UCLA. The greens are going to be tough. It's going to go to a really good putter, somebody that hits the ball solid. And really knows how to hit good second shots. So, it sits right in the middle of some pretty prime real estate.
Amy, you have said you love the flow of the back nine, especially at Bel Air. What should we know?
Bel Air has been reimagined a few times, but most recently by Tom Doak. Doing a really great renovation, I feel, as keeping the water flowing through the 18th, the back nine. There's a lot of really good holes. The par threes on the back nine are really tough. They're long, starting off at number 10, which is like 215 yards. I heard some of the players talking earlier in the week. And then you get long par threes that I think will really be important when you talk about hitting fairways and greens. It's and the closing holes are tough, 16, 17, 18, a long uphill par three, and then a great left to right par four coming down the hill, and then playing back into the clubhouse under the swinging bridge there. So it's just has a wonderful flow of holes that I think will challenge these great women players.
Amy, you turned professional right out of high school in L.A. You won right after you turned 19, and you were Rookie of the Year. Do you see that level of preparedness out there now, that it wasn't quite that common back in your day that somebody could win right at the start of their career? But when you look at the field this week, do you see players who you think are capable of winning on the LPGA Tour right now?
You know, it's really hard right now to differentiate an amateur from a professional. You know, I think we're in kind of this golden age, not only for, you know, women in the sport of golf and junior golf, the, you know, this burgeoning growth in golf over the COVID period and now more and more women playing. But the quality of golf that's coming out of colleges, out of primarily a lot of these great Asian countries that are, you know, producing players, not just Asia, I mean, all over Europe and the world. I think we're seeing this really golden age, and it's really hard. You know, I'm the captain of the Junior Solheim Cup, going to be played in a couple of weeks in September in Spain. I got to tell you, several of these gals are playing over at Bel Air and contending. Four of them look like they've made the cut and are could go out and win the U.S. Amateur, even though they're under 18 years old. So, you know, I always say it's about ultimate preparation. And I think when I was 18 years old, went on the tour, I was kind of ultimately prepared. I couldn't hit enough golf balls. And I think it's now, there's a lot of golfing machines out there that are real great quality of golf being played.
Amy, I read that your parents didn't even play golf, that you came to golf by hitting, you know, soup cans and different things like that. Is that a true story?
Yeah, it's we had the Alcott Golf and Country Club, affectionately known on Avondale Avenue, where I grew up here in West LA. You know, I was a child of television. I watched all those great shows on TV, like the CBS Golf Classic, Shell's Wonderful World of Golf, Big Three Golf. And I fell in love with the sport, the artistry of it, watching it on TV when I was 10 years old. And my dad gave me a cutoff golf club about 15 inches long with some black duct tape. He was not a golfer. He was a handball player. He was a kind of a New York street kid. And my mother played some tennis, and but nobody played golf. We turned the whole house into, I had a sand trap in the front yard. We put a huge screen up, and everybody thought the Alcotts were always fumigating because I had a screen up so that I could hit real balls out of the bunker and not break my own window. And that always came out of my allowance. But, you know, they used to call me the homegrown pro. And I guess I was. It just came out of a love and fascination for the artistry of the game and junior golf and a very short, like, amateur career. I was telling somebody I didn't play in a lot of U.S. women's amateurs because I turned pro so young. You know, I played in five or six U.S. juniors and finished well and then won one. And then right after that, right out of high school, I went on the golf pro tour. So it was not something anybody did back in the 1970s, but I'm glad I did. It's been an education of a lifetime.
That love of the game has never left you, Amy. The U.S. Senior Women's Open is coming up in a few weeks in Oregon. Are we going to see you there?
Absolutely. I always balk at that every year. But, you know, I've been playing a lot of golf lately. I'm working on widening my stance a little bit because it could get a little narrow. But I'm hitting the ball well. I've got a game tomorrow that should test my moxie a little bit over at Riviera with some guys. So I'm trying to play a little bit more. And, you know, the USGA is great because we were petitioning for a U.S. Senior Open for many, many, Women's Open for many, many years. And I remember the meeting we had in Pinehurst several years back. And, you know, kudos to people like Mike Davis and now, you know, Mike Wan for, you know, seeing the vision of that. And that, you know, the golf ball doesn't know how old you are. And just because you've played on the tour and, you know, you're oftentimes your career is more of a trip down memory lane. It's really terrific to have these events to participate in. So it's always great to see everybody, but I still have some fire in my belly, so I'm going to go do my thing.
Love hearing it. Glad you're still traveling. Glad you're still playing. Thanks for the education on LA golf as always, Amy. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks, guys. Always great to be with you.
When Golf Today returns, we're celebrating the arrival of the Big Ten here at NBC Sports as college football season just around the corner. Mike Small, the head coach of the Fighting Illini men's golf team, knows a thing or two about Big Ten titles. He joins us next.
And Mike Small joins us now. Mike, thanks for the time. You're setting a remarkably high standard every season out there. Does it get harder with each passing year to match the bar that you've just set the year before?
Well, thank you for that. And I think it does. It gets harder. College golf is getting harder. Competition is getting stronger. I think in all forms of competitiveness, when you try to upstage yourself, you start thinking, you start having expectations, that makes things harder too. But as long as we stay in our lane, and as a coach, as long as you enjoy coaching the players you have and trying to maximize what you have here, I think it all stays in perspective. But yes, it does get harder. College golf is booming, blossoming, and players are getting better. Obviously, the Golf Channel's contribution to the game has helped college golf grow, and it's becoming more and more important to a lot of more people.
Mike, how have you built a powerhouse in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois?
Well, I don't know if we have enough time, Damon, but it's taken 23 years. But I think just a lot of passion, a lot of excitement, a lot of energy. 23 years ago, we had to have a plan. And we put something together, a mission statement, and we needed to bring a bunch of facets into play with, obviously, donor involvement and facilities and scheduling and the ability to just have a big plan of what you wanted to do. But you need players. You need good quality student athletes to be a part of that. And I think we've done a very good job of bringing in players that want to be at Illinois, want to play for the school, but also want to build their brand and hopefully have a chance to play professional golf when they're done. And I think when we kind of explain that plan and explain to them how we want them to get that education, get that degree, but also plan for a career in professional golf, that's what these kids want. And I think you've seen the last probably 15, 16 years, every player that comes to Illinois wants to win championships here, but they also want to take their trade to the next level. And that doesn't go away. That's something that's been here since the very start. It's going to stay till the very end that I'm here. And I think when kids see that and feel that passion and see that when they're at school, when they're here, they have the facilities and all the wherewithal to be as good as they can be, but to never lose that drive, lose that goal of seeing if they can play at the next level and making a career out of it. And I think that's something that we've done a very good job of. And the players have, like I said, grabbed a hold of it, have the passion, have the desire to keep growing as players and competing. And, that carrot is always out there for them. And that's something I think that's pushed us on to the next level.
One of those players who seems to be destined for great heights, Adrien de Montchassard, who just left you, Mike. He won his first start on the Corn Ferry Tour, lost a playoff in his second, and in six starts, tied for 10th, is his worst finish. What's the ceiling for this kid?
It's a very, very high ceiling. It's something that when Adrien showed up on campus 5 years ago, you knew he had pro qualities. He had the ability to score the golf ball. He had touch and feel around the greens, but he wasn't quite worldly yet or didn't really know how he was going to react under certain situations. But you knew he had the talent and the capabilities to adapt to whatever level he goes to. And obviously he leaves the first team All-American, one of the best players, if not the best player, to have a college career at Illinois. We've had two individual national champions, but Adrien's ascent and consistency for 5 years is pretty remarkable. And to see him go to the next level and just take professional golf and understand that it is just golf, and that he was trained and he practiced and he visualized and he believed while at Illinois what it took to get there. And he realizes this next level is just an extension of playing at Illinois and playing college golf. And I don't think he's made it bigger than it is. And his talents are coming out very consistently and very obviously positively early. But he's a player that his game will grow, and he will adapt to whatever level of competition he is at. And obviously next year he'll be on the PGA Tour, and I expect him to have bright, shiny moments there too. Now, we all know that professional golf is full of peaks and valleys, and very rarely does everybody play good all the time, and well, never really. And now he hasn't really experienced playing poorly as a pro yet, but when that time comes, and that falls into a little bit of a funk, his maturity, his habits, his ability to believe in himself is going to bring him through those quicker than probably somebody else, I believe. So I believe his valleys will be quicker and his peaks will be just as high as anybody. And I think he'll have a long, prosperous career on tour.
Mike, it seems like modern-day golfers are great overall all-around athletes. I read that your father played college basketball at Illinois, 6'2", 185 pounds. Bill Small, 439 points in 26 games, won a Big Ten title. How much hoop did you play growing up?
That's pretty impressive, Damon. Man, you got it all. You know that?
Thanks, Parts.
I tell you what, I grew up very proud of my father, very proud of what he did in college, and that's a big reason why I came to Illinois. Obviously, his had great memories, and I played basketball in high school, but my dad had very big hands, very athletic. Obviously, we just talked, a very good career. I got my mom's hands. They're not very big. So for me to play basketball was kind of tough, but I played it at a decently high level, but my level is golf. And I think the sports that I played and the competitiveness I learned in basketball and playing all those years helped in my golf career. And I think being around an athlete like my dad, and my brother, who played baseball at Illinois, has helped my coaching. And it's just something that I think feeds on each other. But as a coach, kind of, you know, to your point, the better athletes you see can be the better golfers. And, you know, I played on PGA Tour and I played a bunch on the Champions Tour. And all those guys are still very good athletes. And they always were. And I don't think very many players on the PGA Tour are poor athletes. But obviously, there's some out there that practice hard and really ingrain their skills through practice and repetition. But when you combine that effort and that repetition with athleticism, which a lot of those guys have, almost all of them, that's why they're at the highest level in professional golf. So athleticism is a big deal. And if it carries down from generation to generation, well, then well be it.
Mike, you've talked about what your coaching philosophy is and what's expected of the guys who come to play for you. How often do you see or find really talented players who can do everything with a golf ball but just can't quite match those other intangibles that are required to make their way through a college career to the next level?
Oh, that's a very good question, and you see that a lot. There are just as many players in college golf that can stand on the range and just pipe it and hear a special sound, and they can strike the ball really well, but their scores just don't match. And but that's the secret recipe, and you know that. You guys are, you know, I listen to you guys, and you guys know the game just as well as anybody. And that's what separates the winners and losers in this game, is who can get the ball in the hole the fastest and most efficiently, and not always is it done the prettiest. Now, if you can compress the ball and you can control the golf ball and the flight of your ball with the ability to score and manage your emotions and manage the golf course and handle adversity, well, then you have something. But a lot of kids, a lot of players, are weaned off of the progression in golf based on their ability to handle all the extraneous stuff and all the little things, the small things in the game that add up to success. And but you do have to be able to compress it if you want to play and be able to hit the golf ball the way you want to hit it if you're going to play at the highest level. But I believe it's a 20 to 25% of the equation of actually hitting the golf ball equating to winning. But so much of the game is understanding the nuances and how your emotions and how your mind relate to getting yourself around the golf course in the most peaceful and straight, you know, and direct manner.
Well, Mike, you've coached them up as well as anybody in the history of the game. Thanks so much for the time. Congrats on all the success with the program in Illinois.
Thanks, guys, for everything. Thanks for the support of college golf by the Golf Channel. And, you know, it's fun. This is turned into a heck of a career. And the best thing is you're coaching good kids and good players.